facing Native American communities. And Ms. Deb Haaland's office declined repeated requests for an interview. "The stakes are very, very high," said Fawn Sharp, president of the National Congress of American Indians. She added, "We're running out of time." Chilute Nation is a collection of about 135 homes on a narrow slice of land at the edge of the Olympic Peninsula that juts into the Pacific Ocean about 100 miles west of Seattle. As temperatures rise, the atmosphere holds more water, producing more frequent and intense storms. High winds now regularly knock out the electricity, while homes along the main street are vulnerable to flooding. The single road that connects the community to the outside world is often rendered impassable by water. "The village is 10 to 15 feet above sea level," said Susan Devine, a project manager who is working with the Chilute. "During major storms, those waves are bigger than you," she said. "Hundreds of years ago, the reservation was a fishing village, among many locations used by the Chilute as they moved according to the demands of the weather. That changed in 1855, when a treaty stripped the tribe of most of its land." U.S. President at the time, Grover Cleveland, later issued an executive order confining the Chilute to a single square mile, and all of it exposed to flooding. "No one chose to be in a seasonal fishing area year-round," Ms. Devine said. The resulting vulnerability has pushed the tribe to pursue a solution that few non-native towns in the United States have seriously considered: retreating to higher ground. "Climate change has forced us to make the heart-wrenching decision to leave this village," Doug Woodruff, chairman of the Chilute Tribal Council, said in a December statement. "Without a cohesive national and international strategy to address climate change, there is little we can do to combat these impacts." Through a spokeswoman, Doug Woodruff and other members of the council declined repeated requests to be interviewed. In 2012, Congress gave the tribe permission to relocate inside the adjacent Olympic National Park. But without a tax base to pay for its move, the tribe sought federal money. Progress has been slow. The Chilute received about $50 million in grants to build a new school farther from the coast, but the total cost to relocate homes and the other facilities could be 2 to 3 times that much, according to Larry Burtness, who manages federal grant applications for the Chilute. 40 miles south, the Kinault tribe has been working on its own plan to retreat from Tahola, the reservation's main town, for almost a decade. Tucked between a driftwood-strewn beach and a coastal rainforest, Tahola is exposed to storms, flooding, and frequent power outages. That tribe has also struggled to get federal help. "There's no single source of revenue at the state level or congressionally to undertake these kinds of projects," said Ms. Sharp, who was president of Kinault Nation until March. The U.S. federal government offers help to communities coping with the effects of climate change, but Native Americans have often been less able to access that help than other Americans. "We're the most disproportionately impacted by climate, but we're the very least funded," said Anne-Marie Chischilly, executive director of the Institute for Tribal Environmental Professionals at Northern Arizona University. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is less likely to grant requests for aid from Native tribes recovering from disaster compared to non-Native communities, according to FEMA data. Native Americans are also less likely to have flood insurance, making it harder to rebuild. Of 574 federally recognized tribes, fewer than 50 participate in the National Flood Insurance Program, according to a review of FEMA data. That's partly because the federal government has completed flood maps for just one-third of federally recognized tribes, compared with the vast majority of counties. Flood maps can help the tribal leaders more precisely understand their flood risks and promote residents to purchase flood insurance. But insurance premiums can be prohibitively expensive for Native Americans. Individual households on Native American lands are also less likely to get federal help girding for disasters. Of the 59,303 properties that have received FEMA grants since 1998 to prepare for disasters, just 48 were on tribal lands, according to Carlos Martin, a researcher at the Urban Institute. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, said it is committed to improving tribal access to its programs. Chirfonak's efforts to relocate its preschool illustrate the current difficulties of dealing with the federal government. While the Federal Emergency Management Agency offers grants to cope with climate hazards, replacing the school wasn't an eligible expense, according to Max Neal, a senior program manager at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium who helped Chirfonak search for federal aid. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has a program to pay for infrastructure on tribal lands, but the maximum amount available wasn't enough for a new school, and the agency wouldn't grant money until the village had found other ways to make up the difference. Replacing the preschool would only begin to address Chirfonak's troubles. Some 24 homes need to be relocated, potentially costing more than $10 million, according to Sean Baginski, an engineer working with the village. And Chirfonak is just one of more than 100 native villages in Alaska alone that are exposed to significant climate risks.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
وبنور وجهك الذي أضاء له كل شيء يا نور يا قدوس يا نور يا قدوس يا نور يا قدوس.
Dear listeners, in the previous programs, we talked about different phrases in the beginning of this dua. We talked about وَبِوَجْهِكَ الْبَاغِي بَعْدَ فَنَاءِ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ. I ask you by your face, which subsists after annihilation of all things. So the supplicant up to now has called out unto his Lord, the Lord who's pre-existing and eternal. And he knows that nothing in this world exists independently. The supplicant continues, وَبِأَسْمَائِكَ الَّتِي مَلَأَتْ أَرْكَانَ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ. I ask you, O Allah, by your names, which have filled the foundations of all things. So, وَبِأَسْمَائِكَ الَّتِي, and by your names, the word asma, or names, in this divine phrase, that does not merely denote the lexical names that are composed of series of letters, but it is talking about the attributes. These asma are indicating the facts, concepts, and attributes which these names connote. Almighty Allah's mercy, knowledge, justice, and power are the basics for all things. In other words, all things are signs of the Almighty Allah, the creative, the shaper, the all-knowing, all-seeing, the just, the wise, the merciful, and the compassionate. The creatures are all created, continue existence, and obtain sustenance based on these facts and attributes of the Almighty Allah. So the supplicant is not looking at these asma as mere combination of letters. The lexical names are manifestations of the real names, of the attributes. What are significant in the existence, identity, and repute of all things are the real names, not the lexical ones. Anyhow, Allah's real names are mediators for the happening of actualities in this world. That's why in the supplication we are recommended to recite and read in Friday afternoons, we say, Allahumma inni as'aluka bismika al-azim al-a'zam al-a'azz al-ajall al-akram. O Allah, I ask you by your great name, the most powerful, the most notable, the most worthy, الذي إذا دعيت به على مغالق أبواب السماء للفتح بالرحمة فتحت. By which, if you are called for opening the heaven's doors, they are opened by mercy. وَإِذَا دُعِيتَ بِهِ عَلَى مَضَائِقِ أَبْوَابِ الْأَرْضِ لِلْفَرَجٍ فَرَجَتْ. If you are called for opening the earthly doors, they are opened. وَإِذَا دُعِيتَ بِهِ عَلَى الْعُسْرِ لِلْيُسْرِ تَيَسَّرَتْ. And if you are called by those names for relieving the troubles, they are relieved. وَإِذَا دُعِيتَ بِهِ عَلَى الْأَمْوَاتِ لِلنُّشُورِ انْتَشَرَتْ. And if you are called by your great name for the resurrection of the dead, they will be alive. وَإِذَا دُعِيتَ بِهِ عَلَى كَشْفِ الْبَأْسَاءِ وَالضَّرَّاءِ انْكَشَفَتْ. And if you are called for removing poorness and anxiety, they are removed.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the beneficent, the merciful. Oh Allah, bless Muhammad and his progeny. Oh Allah, I beseech you, by your mercy which encompasses everything, and by your power by which you overcome everything, and which submits to it everything, and humble before it is everything. And by your might by which you conquer everything, and by your majesty against which nothing can stand, and by your greatness which prevails over everything, and by your authority which is exercised over everything, and by your own self that shall endure forever after everything has vanished, by your names which manifest your power over everything, and by your knowledge which pervades everything, and by the light of your face which illuminates everything. O He who is light, O He most holy, O He who is light, O He most holy.
So what materializes the needs stated in this supplication is not the mere name that is consisted of the letters. The name itself and its reality is the one we're talking about. The attributes that are the basis for all things are the reality of the existing realities, which are called the names in the Holy Quran, and of course some of the traditions. Among the manifestations of Almighty Allah's name is the Prophet's household and the infallible Imams, alayhim salam, who have special characteristics. And we all know that they are the mediators of Almighty Allah's mercy for people, and they will be so until the day of resurrection. Almighty Allah's mercy and guidance is granted to the people through the Imams, and the believers' deeds are also accepted through them. The great scholar Al-Fayl al-Kashani, in his valuable commentary of Quran, has narrated Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said, نحن والله الأسماء الحسنى الذي لا يقبل الله من العباد عملا إلا بمعرفتنا. By Allah, we, the Prophet's household, are Allah's glorious names. Allah accepts not a single deed from His servants except that they know us and appreciate our position. So, as a result, concentrating to the Lexus does not benefit the human or manifest a reality for him. We should go beyond the words, we should go beyond the phrases to the realm of reality. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Inhumane sanctions imposed on Iran by the West and the U.S. have hampered the country's efforts to purchase vaccines. The sanctions not only targeted the Iranian oil and banking sector, but also hit pharmaceutical companies and are in violation of the UN Charter. Meanwhile, the United States has recently issued a guide to pave the way for the delivery of masks, respirators, and vaccines to countries subject to severe sanctions, such as Iran. That's 16 months after the beginning of the pandemic, when the Islamic Republic has made its vaccine and over 82,000 Iranians have died from the coronavirus. The Islamic Republic has managed to join the few countries around the world developing vaccines to fight the coronavirus disease by producing its first domestic COVID-19 vaccine, known as Coviran Barakat. Iran will focus on using three locally made COVID-19 vaccines, including Russia's Sputnik V and a vaccine jointly produced with Cuba named Pasteur-Covac vaccine. Iran has also launched a clinical trial of yet another vaccine dubbed Nura as part of its drive to develop COVID-19 jabs. Iran is also participating in the COVAX scheme. That's why the United Nations had previously slammed the group of seven wealthy nations for failing to come up with a plan to vaccinate the world against COVID-19. For months, the United States, Britain, and Canada practiced vaccine hoarding, even as poorer nations elsewhere had yet to even distribute doses to their medical workers on the front lines of the pandemic. The U.S., its European allies, and their sanctions regime have targeted ordinary Iranian citizens who are facing one of the worst global health crises. Meanwhile, Iran has managed to develop local vaccines amid cruel sanctions and is prepared to mass-produce jabs to provide the world.
Firstly, it says that the Islamic Republic of Iran has a moral medical obligation. It's actually not necessarily trying to profiteer from this vaccine, as with the Pfizer and other vaccines, which are charging very high rates even here. They're making money out of it. It's basically big business. The Islamic Republic of Iran, clearly at something like $8 a shot, isn't profiteering. And I think that, in a way, is one thing which is very positive. The other thing it says about Iran is that it has an ability to do things itself. This advancement in medical fields, in technological fields, scientific fields, bodes very well for Iran's future. It's not relying on the West.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, received his first dose of the Coviran Barakat vaccine on Friday. Coviran Barakat vaccine was approved for emergency mass application by the country's health ministry earlier this month. Before receiving his first dose of the Coviran Barakat vaccine, the leader had set two prior conditions. First, insisting not to receive the vaccine outside the schedule that had been devised for the rest of the Iranians, and second, required to receive only Iranian vaccines. After receiving the jab, the leader thanked all those who were involved in the development of the homegrown vaccine. He said there is nothing wrong with using a foreign vaccine along with the Iranian one. However, he noted that he did not want to use a non-Iranian vaccine. That marked the leader's trust in Iranian scientists and his support for domestic production.
I think the first thing it says is that Ayatollah Khamenei himself is demonstrating his approval of this vaccine, and he's showing that he's leading by example in order to instill confidence, one would assume, within the populace as a whole. On the other hand, he's also making it very clear that this vaccine is one that he's accepted because it's produced by the Islamic Republic of Iran, independent of all others.
Coviran Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and it started to be mass-produced on March 29th. That placed Iran among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against coronavirus. Iran is also working on producing several other vaccines to inoculate its population against the pandemic. Under the hardest sanctions, Iran managed to produce its homegrown vaccine. Once again, Iranian scientists proved that nothing is impossible for the Iranian nation, as their will is strong enough to overcome any hardships, including sanctions. Years of foreign-sponsored war in Syria has left more than 380,000 people dead. The UN says nearly 12,000 children have been killed or wounded so far. More than half of Syria's pre-war population of 22 million has fled their homes. Syria is in dire need of help, but surely the West has so far offered nothing but destruction and death to Syrians. The US has targeted Syria with economic sanctions that have severely hit the war-torn country's economy by prohibiting foreign companies from trading with Damascus. Meanwhile, the US and European countries had banned export and investment in Syria, as well as transactions involving oil and hydrocarbon products. Also, smuggling of strategic Syrian resources is another tactic used to put pressure on the government of President Bashar Assad, a move that has caused more instability. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government or a UN mandate. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. One example is the U.S. aid operation into Idlib. The Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad has said that the U.S. push to renew a cross-border aid operation into Syria's Idlib is aimed at supplying terrorist groups and prolonging the war. Meanwhile, Iran has once again underlined the need for a peaceful solution to the Syrian crisis.
We reiterate once more that the Syrian crisis must be settled peacefully and in accordance with principles of international law, particularly respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity of states, non-intervention and non-interference in their internal or external affairs, and peaceful settlement of international disputes.
Majid Takhtrabanchi said the current situation in Syria is the result of foreign intervention as well as Israeli aggression. He warned that these issues can negatively impact regional stability and global peace and security. Damascus is determined to restore its sovereignty over the country's entire expanse. The Assad government has proved effective as Syrians continue to recapture key areas from remnants of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group and other foreign-backed terrorist factions across the country. Nevertheless, the presence of U.S. and European forces in addition to Turkish troops has slowed down its advances.
And President Assad has been on the forefront of the struggle against U.S. imperialism in the region. For many years, the U.S. has sought to dislocate, dismember, destabilize the Syrian nation. We saw this in 2011 through 2015, 2016, some of the roughest years of the U.S. funding Western-backed terrorists, Wahhabis trained and armed and funded by Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, the United States.
Thousands
thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Bashar Assad. After failing to oust the Syrian government through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government stepped up its economic war on Syria by imposing crippling sanctions. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, Joy Hood, warned countries in West Asia against restoring ties with Syria. He also warned the prospect of sanctions against countries that normalize relations with Syria and do business with Damascus. Hood noted that the only way to achieve stability in Syria is through a political process. He also stated that Washington is committed to working with allies, partners, and the UN to ensure that a durable political solution remains within reach. That's why Washington and its allies are inside Syria without the invitation of the Damascus government or a UN mandate.
One of the biggest techniques of U.S. imperialism is to create chaos and destabilization in a country that is anti-imperialist, that is against the empire, that defends its people. They create chaos there, and then they blame that chaos and destabilization on the policies of that government.
Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad called Washington's policy pure hypocrisy, citing wide-ranging U.S. sanctions against the war-torn Arab country. Maqdad further accused Western countries of killing Syrian people with their sanctions. Like it or not, Washington and its allies have failed to oust Bashar Assad, and his government is supported by the Syrian people. The presence of foreign forces in Syria is illegal and must end, as it is the root of instability in the country.
Tensions in the Black Sea are on the rise after a British Navy warship breached Russian territorial waters off the Crimean coast on Wednesday. Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement that Russia's Black Sea Fleet and the Russian Federal Security Service had stopped the violation of the state border by the British destroyer HMS Defender off Crimea's Cape Fyland. According to the ministry, the British military vessel ventured 3 kilometers into Russian territorial waters, prompting a Russian border guard patrol ship to fire warning shots and a Sukhoi 24M bomber to drop bombs in front of the destroyer. Following the warning maneuvers, the HMS Defender left the waters, but the British side denied that warning shots had been fired and that any bombs had been dropped in the path of the HMS Defender. Earlier in the day, Russia said hostile actions by the British warship near Russian territorial waters could not have been carried out without the U.S. green light.
I mean, in the sense that the U.S. and the U.K. are sending their fleet far away from home and obviously making provocative actions that are directly related to their interference in the internal affairs of Ukraine, yes, of course, the United States and the U.K. are guilty of these kinds of unwarranted provocations intended to create pressure on Russia. However, the fact of the matter is that these kinds of incidents are relatively common, and they can be expected. What the only unusual part here is that Russia is not backing down and is not giving in to the British pressure.
Russia has warned that it will defend its borders by all means, including with its military. Russia's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador to strongly protest what it called the British ship's violation of its territory. The ministry said it delivered a strongly worded protest to the envoy over the British Navy ship's, quote, provocative and dangerous actions. It said London would be fully responsible for any consequences if a similar incident happened again. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, however, defended the Navy ship's decision to navigate inside the Russian waters.
I think it was wholly appropriate to use international waters. And by the way, the important point is that we don't recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea. This is part of a sovereign Ukrainian territory. It was entirely right that we should vindicate the law and pursue freedom of navigation in the way that we'd take the shortest route between two points, and that's what we did.
Earlier this month, Russia announced a plan to boost its military presence along its western borders to counter increased NATO activities there. In the meantime, NATO has pressed ahead with its military drills near the Russian ground and maritime borders, a move that Moscow deems provocative.
The frequency with which the NATO, let's refer to the United States and the UK as the key NATO powers, the frequency at which they are doing this and the directness of their approach. There's no pretend here that there was an accident. This is an intentional heightening of military tensions, and it is intentional.
It appears that another Cold War between Russia and the West is likely to be on the horizon. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
Generations of horrific abuse of Indigenous people in Canada once again under the spotlight. A First Nations group in Saskatchewan province has revealed that the remains of hundreds of people, mostly children, were discovered at the site of a former Catholic boarding school there. Local Indigenous leaders want an inquiry into what they call genocide. The First Nations group said that the church that ran the residential school removed the headstones. The piece of tragic news came just weeks after the discovery of the remains of over 200 Indigenous children rattled the country. The latest finds have reopened old wounds in Canada about the notorious residential schools mostly operated by the Roman Catholic Church for the government of Canada. During the 19th and 20th centuries, 130 boarding schools forcibly separated more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their families. The program was aimed at assimilating Indigenous youth, but the schools subjected them to malnutrition and physical and sexual abuse. An estimated 6,000 First Nation kids died while attending these schools. Under mounting pressure, the Canadian government formally apologized for the system in 2008. However, despite growing calls, the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church have refused to apologize.
They're abrogating their responsibilities. By admitting their crimes, they're admitting that they're not following their own teachings. The crimes that they committed are so horrific, and children were beaten for simply speaking their own languages.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Thursday that he was terribly saddened by the new discovery. He said the trauma that Indigenous people feel is Canada's responsibility to bear. But has Ottawa really learned a lesson? And is it serious about alleviating the plight of First Nations? Canada is ranked among the world's seven largest advanced economies. The modern country, with one of the highest GDPs in the world, has long been a popular destination for millions of immigrants from across the globe seeking jobs and a better life. While Canada may sound like a dream world to many, it is far from a utopia for its own Indigenous population. Canada's 1.7 million Indigenous citizens, nearly 5% of the population, mostly live in isolated communities where poverty, high unemployment, and high rates of suicide are chronic problems.
There are psychological problems that have been passed down from generation to generation. Fathers who were in the generations in the residential schools and mothers suffered severe psychological problems because of the treatment they received. And that's just been passed down from generation to generation. And it's going to take years to correct that.
They have long complained that they are not getting a fair share of incomes from resources on their ancestral lands. Meanwhile, Aboriginal women have been subjected to deadly violence for many years. A national public inquiry concluded a few years ago that about 1,200 Aboriginal women have been murdered or gone missing in Canada since 1980. With activists putting the number much higher. Human rights groups have repeatedly raised the alarm about the situation of Canada's indigenous population. Canada says it is ashamed of systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice that indigenous peoples have faced. In 2017, the Canadian government acknowledged the humiliation, neglect, and abuse of First Nations and pledged to improve their lives. But First Nations are still struggling with a long list of problems and are fighting an uphill battle for their rights.
School in the Ukrainian capital, kids learn about saving the environment and helping those in need through a creative way. Students put plastic bottles in a machine as a currency. Then they can select what they would like to spend the money on, buying food for stray animals and donating to children with special needs are their choices. The project was first launched in a mall in Kiev a few months ago. Afterwards, designers found out that children were the most frequent users of the machine.
A child drops a bottle inside and sees an immediate result. It brings joy and happiness, and everyone is excited and wants the project to thrive.
The founders seek to install more machines in schools across Ukraine to raise environmental awareness amongst younger generations. Since the start of the project in October last year, over 5 tons of plastic has been collected from 6 machines. India is known not only for its cultural diversity, but also for a vibrant assortment of uncountable dishes. Butter chicken is the only one delight you wouldn't like to miss while visiting Indian restaurants, especially if it is prepared by a celebrity chef like Saransh Goyla. Goyla's coal-fired oven is now sending a mouth-watering scent through India's commercial hub Mumbai as the young chef takes a break from COVID-19 relief efforts and resumes work. He is the one who established the first global butter chicken brand and authored the acclaimed food travelogue, India on My Platter. But with the coronavirus forcing people into isolation, his networks were also hit. So Goyla launched a non-profit platform called COVID Meals for India in April to connect thousands of volunteer home cooks and frontline workers.
The pandemic had a large impact on our business. Having said that, Goyla Butter Chicken from the start was always focused on deliveries and takeaway. So in that sense, our loss of revenue and a loss of business was slightly lesser than an average restaurant. But a lot of my friends, restaurateurs who are in this industry have gone through an extremely tough time. The pandemic has taken its toll on our industry, and I think it has set us back by at least a couple of years.
Goyla found his calling early, winning a televised cooking competition at the age of 25, which led him to host a travel program showcasing regional Indian cuisine. His profile exploded in 2018 when he was invited by former MasterChef Australia judge George Kalambaris to be a guest on the hit show, with contestants asked to recreate his signature dish.
Graduation is an exciting moment for all schoolgoers, but the occasion turns more joyful if it ends with a celebration like Scarlet Sales Festival, which is held in St. Petersburg in Russia at the end of the school year. The annual event is part of the famous White Nights Festival, traditionally held in summer with spectacular fireworks, numerous music concerts, and a massive water show. Normally, thousands of domestic and foreign tourists flock to the city to watch the colorful event. But this year, the COVID-19 pandemic limited the number of the attendees. The festival began in the 1960s when several Russian schools united to celebrate the end of the academic year. That is in connection with the symbolism of the popular 1922 children's book, Scarlet Sails, by Alexander Grimm. Indonesia is dealing with a surge in coronavirus infections, but that has not stopped the people from observing the Yatnya Kasada Festival. Thousands of people bravely climbed to the summit of Mount Bromo in eastern Java province to observe the ancient ritual. They made offerings ranging from fruits and crops to livestock by throwing the items to the pit of an active volcano. They believe the practice brings blessings and plenitude and helps them express gratitude for what they have. This year's festival was overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic, with participants required to adhere to strict health protocols. China's space agency has released videos of its first Mars rover as it's exploring the red planet's surface. The rover is named Zhurong. It's now investigating a vast plain known as Utopia Planitia on Mars's northern hemisphere. The rover successfully landed on Mars in mid-May. It is studying the red planet's surface rocks and atmosphere. It also looks for signs of life, including any subsurface water or ice. The solar-powered Chinese robot weighs around 240 kilograms and has 6 wheels. China is the second country after the U.S. to operate a rover on Mars. A university in the Venezuelan capital Caracas has turned its roof into a garden and uses sustainable energy to light up its classes. The roof of Andres Bello Catholic University is covered with plants and 30 solar panels. The panels, along with a wind turbine, produce the 7,400 watts of electricity to illuminate that area and light 2 rooms in the building. The roof is now functioning as a self-sufficient and environmentally friendly open-air classroom. The proposal for the project was put forward by 2 students. The aim is to educate people about renewable energy and the threat of climate change.
A small New Hampshire town has been hit by a series of car break-ins over the last few weeks. People were shocked when they finally discovered the mischievous criminal. A large black bear has been identified as the bandit wreaking havoc in the town of Fulton. The naughty mammal was caught on camera as it got on its 2 hind legs and skillfully opened the door of a car. Police say the bear was most likely rummaging for food. Authorities have asked people to remove food from their cars to avoid enticing the troublesome animal. A Jordanian woman is receiving high demands for the soap she produces. Why? Because she uses an unusual ingredient. Lara Altiti makes soap out of camel milk. She tours different cities in Jordan to find the best camel farms for her business. Titi uses camel milk as the major ingredient for the soap she produces. That's because she says it has rich benefits and contains more vitamins than cow milks.
The first stage includes weighing the soap, and I include different kinds of oil to preserve the quality of the soap and its therapeutic benefit. We need to have high foam and tough consistency, and we don't want it to be rancid. We place high importance on the therapeutic material that we add during the production process.
Titi started her soap line at home using a manual process and then expanded it to an independent workshop. Her soap line has now become very popular in Jordan. Titi produces more than 4,000 soap bars a month. She sells them both to domestic and international customers.
If you're a car lover, this story is for you. Over 300 classic vehicles have taken part in a retro rally across Estonia. The 1,000-kilometer rally kicked off in the town of Pärnu. It drew participants from Latvia and Finland. Their motto is Straight Ahead to the Past. The vintage cars participated in the event are mostly produced between 1930 and 1980. Experts say all the vehicles are in good condition. However, they doubt if all the vehicles can make it to the end of the five-day rally.
German firm's electric air taxi takes its first flight at a show in an airport near the French capital, Paris. Volocopter's flying taxi, which looks like a tiny helicopter, took off and landed vertically over the airport with no passenger on board during a three-minute trial. Aside from its two-passenger capacity, the aircraft also has some room for luggage. It flew a 500-meter route at speeds of up to 30 kilometers per hour and 30 meters high along the airfield. The flying taxi service would first be operated by a licensed pilot, but the flight would be fully automated over a period of time.
With respect to regulation, initially we will have a fully certified, fully licensed helicopter pilot, just to fit into existing regulation. But we believe over time it can be much simpler to obtain such an operating license for a volocopter. And of course, in the last instance, we want to take a pilot requirement out. We want these vehicles to fly fully automated. So you will not need a pilot license anymore. You can just summon the volocopter. It will come and pick you up and bring you safely to your destination.
The German firm is entering the urban mobility market with high hopes of playing a major role in the infant industry. Volocopter says its objective is to have a service in operation for 2024 for the 2024 Olympic Games. Walking around the city without shoes can be delightful. If you're interested in the experience, visit the Russian capital. A 3.5-kilometer long barefoot trail has recently opened in Moscow's Elk Island Park. It's made of various materials such as pine bark, beach pebbles, and clay. Taking around 40 minutes to complete, the path attracts hundreds of visitors every day. However, some people find it difficult to walk without shoes, calling the path a torture trail. A zoo in Turkey has welcomed a baby elephant from an endangered species. The birth of a female calf at Izmir Wildlife Park has caused excitement in keepers and visitors. The calf, yet to be named, is the third offspring of parents from Asian species. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature classifies the Asian elephant as endangered due to their rapid decline in the wild. The Asian elephants are primarily threatened by poaching, fragmentation, and loss and degradation of habitat. Currently, around 20 to 40,000 Asian elephants are living across the world, five of which inhabiting Turkey's Izmir Zoo.
A Palestinian artist has come up with the idea of making children feel happy after the recent Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip left many people dead. Amna Sami is a young Palestinian artist who has gathered Palestinian kids in the city of Beit Lahia, north of Gaza. That's where houses were destroyed by Israeli airstrikes and bombings during the recent aggression on the territory. Sami draws the Palestinian flag as well as the map of Palestine on children's cheeks as patriotic symbols. She says she does that to say that these people in the midst of destruction will become strong again. Sami says by painting on kids' faces, she wants to send a message to the world.
I'm sending a message to the world that our children should live like other children in the world, away from danger and destruction. It is their right in life to live as children in a safe place, a place that gives them something to live a normal life.
Palestinian kids say they feel happy when Sami paints their faces. The Israeli regime launched this devastating onslaught on Gaza in early May. At least 256 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed during the 11-day war. A Turkish band has found musical inspiration in a most unlikely place, a local landfill. Here's more. Members of Funk Istanbul have assembled instruments from the dump in a junkyard in Istanbul. They use their ingenious new tools to play Turkish folk music. The band aims to raise awareness about recycling. Turkey is one of the biggest producers of municipal waste globally. The country has a low recycling rate. Only 12% of waste is repurposed there.
Technology has come in handy to rescue animals in disaster zones. American cinematographer Douglas Thron has used a high-tech infrared drone to save animals from fire or storm, or even those who are stuck in trees. The drone he uses has a large thermal camera, a spotlight, and zoom lens. The good point is that the aerial vehicle does not make too much noise, therefore it does not scare away animals.
So what I do is I fly infrared drones primarily at night over disaster areas after a hurricane or a fire hits, and I look for people's pets, whether it be cats or dogs, and I also look for injured wildlife, and then either I or rescue crews will go in and rescue the animals after I spot the animals after these natural disasters.
Thron has so far rescued hundreds of stranded animals in various places in the US and Australia. Emergency services have allowed him to participate in rescue efforts after making sure that the drone works well to achieve its goal.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A video has gone viral showing animals at a U.S. zoo enjoying their bath time becoming clean as a new pimp. Keepers at Chicago's Brookfield Zoo washed the animals to celebrate International Bath Day. From anteaters to rhinos all got sprayed with a water hose. They seemed to love their bath time as it kept them cool in the summer heat. Zoo officials say the occasion is to honor ancient Greek scientist Archimedes, who made a discovery while in the bath.
IRIB English Radio.